I'm going to call the Oil and Gas Committee meeting to order, and we're meeting today jointly with the Senate Transportation Committee. But the Oil and Gas Committee has one small piece of business to propose first, and then we'll get on to the business of the joint hearing. Before us again today is Senate Joint Resolution Number 21, a joint resolution sponsored by Senator Ewing, who's also present, in addition to at least another dozen folks. There's a committee substitute that's before us, and unless the sponsor had any comments, I'd certainly entertain them. I'd accept a motion from one of the committee members to accept the committee substitute.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
There's a motion by Senator Hoffman to accept the committee substitute. Is there objection? Hearing no objection, the substitute's been adopted. What's the pleasure of the committee on the resolution? Representative, excuse me, Senator Tears.
I move CS for Senate Joint Resolution 21 Oil and Gas in committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing none, that resolution is gone. Thank you. Next, now we are meeting jointly with the Senate Transportation Committee. And by your lead, Mr. Chairman, I have a little agenda here, so but feel free to jump in at any time you'd like without having to, if I'm not paying attention, hit me with the gavel. This will be, I think, only the second meeting we've had. We are on teleconference, so our guests from...
I just spoke to both of them. They're dialing in now, so it should be a lot shorter.
All right. So we do have a couple of folks from out of town who will be testifying. You've got a stack of material here, and I'm going to ask my staff, Jeanne Fay, to walk through and let you know what we do have. Also, Professor Harry Bader is here to discuss some of the developments that have taken place in other states on this issue and walk through some of the proposed amendments and some of the responses that we've taken into consideration by people that have already testified or otherwise given us advice on this matter. So that should take about no more than 15 minutes, and then we're going to go straight into to testimony. And we've invited, obviously it's a public hearing, so anyone would be able to testify, but we've specifically asked the industry that might be most closely regulated or most closely affected by this legislation to talk to us today. So with that, I'll ask Jeanne Fay to maybe come over here to this other mic, and maybe Harry, could you join her there? Over to this other chair here. Maybe one of the people in the front row would switch chairs with you so you can move another chair up there.
Okay, my name is Jeanne Fay. I'm an aide for Senator Sam Cotton, Oil and Gas Committee. The package.
Excuse me for just a moment here. I think I forgot a formality I needed to go through. Present today from the Oil and Gas Committee were Senators Hoffman, Pierce, Schultz, and myself, Senator Cotton. Also with us is Senator Ewing and Senate Transportation Chairman and Vice Chairman, Senators Menard and Jones. And that's for the record, so you can continue now.
Okay. A rather sizable packet of information in front of you. I'll basically just sort of walk you through what we have here. And the first thing you'll notice is the Senate Bill, Oregon Senate Bill 500. Essentially, what this does is at the last meeting, remember we had that very large set of proposed amendments that were received in Oregon, California, and Washington in regards to their compact bills, which are essentially identical bills to ours. Senator Bradbury of Oregon agreed to go through all those amendments and synthesize what they believed in consultation with the other states, what would be the best amendments, what we would be interested in adopting. This Senate Bill 500 represents that effort. Essentially, there's two main things that the amendments do. Under Article 1, it changes some of the findings and purpose of the compact. And under Article 5, it changes some of the authority. As the compact was originally proposed, the compact agency had a level of authority that I guess the best way I can describe it is if you have the states at one level and the federal government having a level above them, the compact agency would have basically brought the state sovereignty up to a level that increased its sovereignty and gave it oversight over some of the federal agencies. There was a lot of concern both by some of the federal agencies and by industry of duplicity of regulation and complications. Basically, what some of these amendments do is it moves the compact authority down to a level where it's more advisory on a federal level. It doesn't supersede, it can't tell the Coast Guard essentially what to do. At the same time, it leaves intact more of each state's individual sovereignty. And it makes it more in line with probably the closest analogous other regional compact being the Northwest Planning Council, Power Planning Council. So it's more similar to that. However, in exchange for reducing some of the authority that the compact would have had under the previous version of the legislation, it essentially gives a shortcut into the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, which our guests from the Coast Guard last time discussed with us, that the states have an avenue for influencing federal actions, such as Coast Guard regulations on tanker routes, etc. So why do we need this extra clout? Essentially what this does is previously, and Harry can add in some more of the technical details to my discussion when I'm done, is previously a state could petition the Coast Guard saying, well, for example, we think that this tanker route, if it were 50 miles farther offshore, it would significantly reduce the potential impact of an oil spill on our southeast coast. And they could petition the Coast Guard for that, and they would essentially have to prove first that they had standing to petition the Coast Guard. This essentially shortcuts the process by recognizing that the states in this compact have standing to influence federal regulation. So it gives it sort of a foot in the door, and once the states are sort of in the door wanting to influence some of the regulations, they can petition for a certain change of regulation, and if the Coast Guard does not like that idea or does like that idea, whatever, it means that there's a formal procedure for addressing that concern and responding to it. So that's essentially what these amendments do.
Did you want to just briefly then point out to the members of the committee the remainder of the packet?
Okay.
You needn't get into too much detail on it, but you can point out which piece of information we do have now.
The piece of information after your Oregon bill, actually the third one down, essentially has these boxes. It's a brief discussion of the changes between this version of the compact and the previous one. Following that, there's a memo from Legal Services, from Terry Lauterbach, and it discusses the question of vessel contingency plans, because there's a requirement in the current, in the compact, that contingency plans have to be as comprehensive as ones previously adopted. This discusses contingency plans.
And I think Harry's going to discuss that comprehensive concept when it's your turn to talk.
Okay, then most of the following pieces after that are, there were a number of questions raised last time regarding how does the Federal Oil Pollution Law of 90 interface with the compact, and how do different states' oil spill requirements compare with Alaska. Basically, most of the following sets of information are answers to that question.
All right. Does anyone have any questions for Dina? All right. So, Mr. Bader, you want to identify yourself and proceed?
My name is Harry Bader, and I'm an assistant professor of environmental law and policy at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the School of Resources Management and Agriculture. And the reason, I guess, that I'm speaking today was that 2 years ago, after this bill, I was asked to participate with the Western States Legislative Conference in negotiating a potential compact. And from there, that's been my involvement. My comments today are going to be bifurcated into two parts. The first is to go through the amendments that were made by Oregon, and then in response to Senator Pierce's request at the last hearing for me to clarify what areas I was outvoted in the negotiation process and to propose amendments that would rectify what I would see as a grievous error on the part of the drafting of the compact as it relates to Alaska in terms of protecting our sovereignty within a compact concept. So in the first part, to address the amendments that have been taken thus far, I would first of all like to give some credit where credit's due in that some of these amendments are a direct reflection of the comments that were submitted in writing or made at the last hearing, either from British Petroleum or from the Coast Guard. In large part, they served as a catalyst for reform, which has actually improved the language in the compact, as I'll try to point out. Just to clarify, with Article 1B, 1 and A on page 2, the idea of this language was to reduce the likelihood of compact encroachment on valid existing state authority. And I think this should be read in conjunction with Article 1A, 2, where we specify the limited scope of our compact. In other words, Senator Jones was correct in that we have to make sure that this compact doesn't expand its legal authority into areas of resource management and allocation. And so I think in light of those concerns, these two sections should be read together. But if we still feel that there's a possibility that this can be misconstrued, perhaps we'd want even stronger language. At the moment, I think perhaps that this clarifies that we're not trying to involve ourselves in, I'm speaking out if I were a compact. The compact is not trying to involve itself in an area of resource management and use or allocation. And then finally, that the compact wants to recognize that the state does have valid existing authority, and 1B, 1 through 13, are intended and are rewritten so as to reflect that we're trying, that the compact is trying to tread lightly upon state authority rather than to encroach upon it. The most substantive provision comes from Article 5, and this is what Jenny was referring to, Article 5, 1, A and B. And first of all, I also want to thank Jenny Fay. She's done so much work, she's probably become the foremost expert on interstate compacts now in the state.
I'm trying to pass the buck.
No, she's spurred me on to learn more. What this does is that it is in direct response to the Coast Guard's concern that the compact was trying to supplant its authority for that of the Coast Guard and elevate states into a completely federal sphere. What this has done is that it has formalized a process which is already available substantively through the Administrative Procedures Act. And in effect, it is a redoing of provisions which are similar to the currently existent compact, the Northwest Area Planning Council. And when I say the Administrative Procedures Act, I'm not referring to the Administrative Procedures Act in general. I'm referring to two very specific but little used substantive provisions which heighten the scrutiny that a petition must be assessed under. And those are in the Administrative Procedures Act, sections 553E and 555B of the APA. Now what that does is it establishes that once a party petitioning under these provisions proves that it is an interested party, in other words, it has, it's a sort of like a mini-standing standard, not as rigorous as standing for litigation, but a threshold nonetheless. They can petition a regulatory agency and draft a regulation or draft a modification to a regulation, complete with the analysis and the reasons for that, and submit it to the agency. Now, unlike general public review and comment, which is the norm within APA, the agency must review the petition request in a formalized process where the strictures of due process that have been later enunciated in interpreting APA through the court interpretation of APA are then imposed. And so that is, a affected agency must respond in a timely fashion. Courts have held 6 months is too long. They've held that 3 months is reasonable. But they must respond in a formal response in writing point by point by point, explaining why they reject particular provisions. This is not normally available under the general provisions of APA. Now, what is the advantage of having the compact become a recognized interested party as opposed to going through what is already substantively available to us through these two provisions? The answer is that it saves time, it saves cost, and it creates certainty. And what by that I mean, in terms of time, we don't have to go through the process, the compact doesn't have to go through the process of proving that it's an interested party. If the affected agency, whatever it is, EPA, whatnot, NOAA, they don't have, if there's rejection and they don't abide by the strictures, it doesn't have to be a hearing or even litigation over whether or not they have accorded 553E standing or 553 treatment to a petition. It's all taken care of beforehand. The compact is an interested party. It can have the same substantive powers that would be granted under 553E. And the last one, and perhaps most important in terms of enhancing the state authority, is that 553E is theoretical. I mean, this is what we have available to us as the state of Alaska. But because of the procedural hoops that we have to go through in the 553 calculus, in fact, it may not be available, especially if the state of Alaska petitions, let's say, alone, not under a compact umbrella. A petitioned agency can say, okay, Alaska says it's an interested party, but Oregon is similarly situated. We didn't receive a petition from Oregon. Therefore, we denied interested party status because, and it's just like with a class action suit. When you want to create a class action suit, you want a class that's similarly situated and that is encompassing enough so that there's not a breakdown and you can defeat the action. This compact would provide that scope of a class under 553E. And that's the substantive part of the modifications that were made, is that we're reflecting the concern of the compact overstepping its bounds in terms of sovereignty, if people are concerned about that, and is putting in provisions so that the compact cannot stymie federal agencies, but they do have a more direct and more substantive access, even though, in theory, the substance of that access is the same as it exists under the status quo. In the terms of Article 5.1a.c, which talks about the status being comprehensive in that the compact is not going to be any less than the most comprehensive state prior to compacting, that definitely needs clarification. The intent of the use of the word comprehensive was intended to reflect breadth of authority, not the level or intensity of authority or the rigorousness of the regulation. And the best way to think of that is in terms of subject areas. Let's say California has a civil penalties for lack of preparedness or prevention, and Alaska has incentives for prevention. Comprehensive should be interpreted, and in Oregon has no provision whatsoever for prevention. Comprehensiveness should be interpreted and therefore needs to be clarified to reflect that we're dealing with subject areas. Therefore, the subject area that the compact will regard will include prevention, but not the most rigorous provisions within that subject area. Comprehensiveness needs to be clarified to reflect scope, not intensity of regulation. And the problem is the way it's currently worded, intent aside, it's somewhat ambiguous, and it could be litigated. And I would say avoid the potentiality for litigation at all costs, and let's just rewrite that to reflect that.
Let me interrupt you right there, Harry, too. Like, if you got the memo from Terry Lauterbach, she discusses that on page 2, and she seems to conclude that California's law is more comprehensive because they have specific prevention measures. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you can tie them together because we discussed prevention and I know in 567, that's one of the mitigating allowances there for preparedness. So the subject's covered, but unless it's clarified, you could get two different opinions as we
Correct.
See that we have two different opinions.
And that's a problem. And we did not intend for the most rigorous state's regulation to be the baseline. What we intended is the most comprehensive state in terms of subject areas. But as the example you just brought out shows, you're absolutely correct. It's poorly written. if you don't know exactly what it means, and you have multiple interpretations, it's poorly written, it needs to be changed. And then I'd like to get back to what Senator Pierce asked for me to do and to talk about the areas where I was outvoted in negotiations. There are two concerns of mine, and these deal, actually there's three, I guess, Article 2, number 2 and 8, which is a definition, and then finally Article 7, which is voting. The concerns that I had when we were negotiating with other states is that Alaska is a unique state in regard to the others, and that we have remote communities that are dependent upon diesel fuel and other products being brought in, and that every regulation that we add, if we increase the cost of transportation by a dollar, that's not the same percent increase in terms of the total amount of available income that's consumed, because in these communities, energy costs are disproportionately high. So if we increase energy because of regulation by 10%, that may actually cause a 15 or 20% reduction in the available income. And we can't do that to these communities. And so what I would like to do would be to, and there's two amendments that Jenny Fay provided in the handout, is redefine vessels so as it categorically, explicitly exempts any vessel from compact regulation that's less than 5,000 deadweight tons. Just, well, whatever else is in there, whether the federal government chooses to regulate, that's something else. But the compact cannot get at those vessels.
Does OPA 90 exempt?
OPA 90 has two areas where they implicitly talk about trying to assist smaller vessels. One category is 10,000 deadweight tons, the other is 5,000 deadweight tons, and those refer to retrofitting and liability. But that's implicit, and one of the problems with OPA 90 is that, just like the word comprehensive, is ambiguous. And I would say if we're going to take the very serious step of going into a compact, let's get rid of ambiguous language and not rely on OPA 90 for its implicit inferences and just make it clear that the compact cannot touch those vessels. Because we need, now if someone else regulates them, that's not the compact's authority.
So the feds and the state would still have regulatory authority.
They would still retain jurisdiction.
Senator Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have another concern here. What about industries that rely on certain products, and those industries compete with other industries in Oregon and Washington on world markets or domestic markets, whatever, and they depend on some hazardous substances that they use in their process? What happens when Oregon and Washington teams up and their industries put the pressure on them, you know, and it could actually raise the price of that particular hazardous substance or whatever it is that they use in their process that would make them less competitive to the point where they may not even be able to compete? How do you control something like that?
We're on teleconference too, so Senator Jones, obviously, I think you're directing your question towards Mr. Bader here. I think you're probably referring perhaps to pulp mills. I mean, that seems like a bank.
Yeah, I didn't want to bring up any one particular industry, but I mean, there's...
That's a good example.
That'd be a good example, and they do use some caustic substances that other pulp mills use in Oregon and Washington, and it's a big part of their cost. And, you know, you start raising, you know, put regulations and standards on the vessels, types of vessels, and you raise that price high enough, those mills will no longer be able to compete. And I guess maybe, you know, for some people that may be good, but I have a real concern with that. Mm-hmm.
If I understand you correctly, that's a point very well taken, and that's why that leads to the second amendment, is to protect Alaska's interests in whatever subsequent regulations the compact may actually pass, is that we need to change the way the compact, the way Oregon has it written here, the way the compact does business. And by that I mean go back to the pre-Hawaii agreement that we had, which is every state gets two voting representatives rather than what is in Article 7, it's just one. And rather than require a simple majority of those representatives, that the majority has to contain at least one vote from each member state. And that way we protect Alaska's interest in that a representative from Alaska has to be in the voting majority for a compact provision to pass. Now, one of the things, the reason why, well, why do we need two voting representatives from every state, not just go with one? there are two things that kick in. In a compact, to give a single state automatic veto tends to reduce the likelihood of passage by Congress. It's not anything that is mandatory in compacting constitutional law, because compacts are kind of a negative inference in that no state shall enter into an agreement or compact with another state or foreign government without the consent of Congress. That's the whole run amok of the, and that's the whole ball of wax for constitutional law as it relates to compacting. But tradition has found in the last 200 years that a single state veto won't work. The other one, so that's why we bifurcate the two votes. So technically, Alaska or Oregon or Hawaii doesn't have a single state veto. The other one is that if you expand the number of representatives, you reduce the problem that the Alaska Oil Spill Commission in its final report and findings issued, and that by increasing representation, you reduce the chance of any special interest capture of the entire state delegation. And that's those kinds. So I think that the intent of this amendment is to prevent, let's say, the three states of California, Oregon, and Washington from forming a cartel of sorts and through regulation increasing the price of any one product so that Alaska industries are at a disadvantage.
What prevents one of the delegation from voting with those other states? I mean, it may be a personal feeling of that person that it's the right way to go.
If that person is a duly appointed representative of the state of Alaska, then nothing prevents that, because that person is acting on behalf of the state of Alaska, just like any other representative, whether it's to the U.S. Senate or to the Congress.
I might add that that's one area that we've actually yet to cover, that it's a pretty easy concept to understand, but each state probably has different rules under which they will select their members to this compact. Now, I'm led to believe that perhaps in Alaska the legislature may not have anything to say about it, and the governor might be able to appoint two people. Now, I'm sure that the legislative branch, those of us here, will examine that very closely and find out whether or not we can have a say in that. But that comes, I don't think the answer to your question can show up until you understand every step of that process, know how that person can get on that as a member of that compact.
I'm through with my comments unless there's any other questions for me.
Are you finished, Senator Jones?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions? All right, let's go ahead and go to the folks on the teleconference here, that and we'll take the people that are here in Juneau after that. Is Jerry Asplin on the teleconference network?
Hello.
Yeah, is that Jerry?
Jerry Asplin.
Okay, would you please identify yourself and go ahead and give us your testimony, please?
Yes, my name is Jerry Asplin. I'm president of Aquamarine Incorporated, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead. Hear you loud and clear.
Great. During the last 6 weeks, I've spent many hours studying the proposed compact and have met with many legislatures up and down the coast to discuss the issue. In addition, I was invited to meet with the Western Legislative Conference Ocean Resources Board in La Jolla, and have again been invited to attend their meeting on April 7th in San Francisco. I believe that the objective of the compact is twofold. One is to coordinate marine activities up and down the coast, and secondly, to allow the states more input to federal rulemaking. I support these efforts. I think they're important. And quite frankly, I don't believe that the states in the past have utilized, as I heard just a minute ago, the processes available to them to be involved in some of the federal rulemaking. But I support these only from the standpoint that we can somehow, instead of having a compact, develop another state's DC task force and recommend that we do that, and have a second recommendation to the state, and that would be to establish within the state of Alaska an Office of Maritime Affairs similar to what is presently being established in the state of Washington. If you think about up and down all Pacific coasts, as far as I'm concerned, all states within the United States, very difficult for a marine person to go to any state government and find the right agency in which to discuss marine affairs. So I think an office like
Let me just say that I think everybody's fully aware that the existing authority for state government, at least, ends at 3 miles. In fact, I'm not sure we even have all the authority that's available within that 3 miles. And to some of us, it's one of the attractions of this idea to go beyond that limit, because things that take place between 3 miles and 12 or even on out to 200 miles often affect interest here in Alaska. So that is of interest to me. As far as getting out of the compact, I've heard that as well, but again, the language that we're promoting here, or the proposing, I should say, does very specifically allow for a state to give notice and then elect to leave the compact. As far as whether or not we're the same as, I assume you were talking about the Northwest Power Planning Council. Is that the other compact you were comparing us to?
Yes, there are some 200 compacts that have been made across the United States, and those are very specific in their makeup and their objectives, and this is very broad.
Right. Well, I don't know very much about that Power Planning Council. I don't know, for instance, if they jointly bond, finance, or own assets that would make it very difficult for someone to leave the compact. I think that if that were the case, it would be quite different than the proposal that's before us today.
I can understand that. I again, though, would like to just say that it will be very difficult because of the state supersedence of federal regulation. For us to support any form of a compact that is, in fact, approved by the Congress of the United States.
Okay, without dwelling on it, let me just explore that just a little bit further. Obviously, state law can be more stringent and more comprehensive than federal law, so that's not what you're talking about. You must be talking about superseding federal law in areas that states do not currently have jurisdiction. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, there is a. If you take this far enough, let's just suppose that the compact got into vessel structure, as an example. Then if I were to build a ship in the United States, I would have to build a ship to two different regulations. One, what we'll call the federal regulation, as governed by the Coast Guard, and then another set of regulations that are governed by the compact. It's very difficult to do. You could also have a personnel effect on the situation, where a person could have a license that was issued by the compact, and at the same time have a license issued by the federal government. I do believe that you do have a place, and I wish that you took a real active interest in developing some of the federal regulations, and I like the kind of discussion that you had about taking a more active interest in that. I think that's important for all of us, and I think that also will give more of a broad spectrum to some of the federal regulations. But I just think that there's a better way to do it than a compact.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jerry. I think I understand the nature of your concerns, and I think that there are some details, including some of the discussion we had today on some of the proposed amendments that begin to approach your concerns. But I'm sure we'll discuss this more later, and I may come to that meeting on the 6th and 7th of April as well, so have a chance to follow it up at that point.
I hope to see you there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The other person on the network today is Tom Mullen. I'm not sure where this person is, but please identify yourself and let us know who you represent.
Hi, yes, I am on it. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm Tom Mullen. I'm actually Ohio. I'm manager of environmental and external affairs for BP Oil Shipping Company. And for reference, BP Oil Shipping Company charters the fleet with some 25 vessels carrying
Mr. Mullen, this is the moderator, Juno. Are you on a speakerphone? And if you are, could you speak a little more directly? And you're breaking up rather badly.
Okay, I'm on a handset, but I will try to speak more clearly. Is that any better?
Very good.
Okay. Briefly, I wanted to share some comments we have on the compact bill. I think I have a bit of a mixed message, but also one that echoes very closely the comments of Captain Asplund, which you just heard. While BP supports interstate or multiple states,
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Other questions? Apparently not. At this point, we'll then invite people that are here in Juneau that wish to testify to come forward at this time. Do we have a sign-in sheet? Thank you. Could you not wish to testify, Dave?
Mr. Chairman, you have copies of our written remarks, and I really can't add anything to that. They're very similar to those expressed by ARCO and BP.
Okay, thank you very much. We also had made a request to the Department of Environmental Conservation to supply the committee with some information comparing Alaska's laws to other states, and perhaps you have something in writing there as well that you could just deliver to us.
Sorry.
Okay, so did you have any remarks that you wish to make at this time? All right. So the other two people that are, one other person wishes to testify, and then that's going to allow this committee to adjourn and attend a meeting next door on the Exxon settlement. So Teresa, is it Scavera?
Svankera.
Could you pronounce it for us, please?
Svankera.
Svankera. All right, welcome. Please push your little switch on your machine forward. And
good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Teresa Svankera, and I'm a volunteer with the Alaska Environmental Lobby. The Alaska Environmental Lobby strongly supports the formation of the Pacific Ocean Resources Compact. It would empower the states most likely damaged by oil and other hazardous substance spills and allow them to act in a unified manner to prevent and respond to spills. In thinking about prevention and response to spills, it comes to mind that we've just passed the second anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I hope a lot of you have had time to reflect on that. I know I certainly have, and it certainly reopens a wound for me. I've lived in Valdez for 9 years, and I've sailed Prince William Sound and explored many of the isolated anchorages. After the spill, I documented wildlife mortality, and I conducted damage assessment research for the state. I experienced the tragedy of picking dead birds soaked in oil from the water, and I also watched oil-coated sea otters crawl out onto a beach to die a painful death from ingesting oil. I watched my favorite place in the world smother in oil. Ever since the spill, I felt strongly that we must learn from this tragedy and do all that we can never to let this happen again. I believe we have an opportunity now by supporting Senate Bill 102 to show that we have learned from the spill and are committed to act more responsibly in protecting our ocean resources. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Teresa. Are there others here today that you know, you didn't sign up with wish to make some comments today? Apparently not. Do the committee members have any other comments, questions, requests for more information? Give my attention to, if I can, I'm going to attend that meeting in San Francisco on the 6th and 7th and encourage others on the committee if they're interested to do the same. It's a Saturday and Sunday, so you can probably get in and out and not miss any days at work here. So it would be my intention to have another meeting after that, get together with representatives from the five Pacific states so we can compare progress. And it's never been my, I wasn't sure at first, but it's now my intention probably not to attempt to get this legislation passed the legislature this year, definitely continue to take it seriously as one of the options that I think is very credibly before us. And perhaps this legislature may want to pass legislation that would have Alaska become part of this compact. But again, at this point, don't expect the legislature to do it this calendar year.
Mr. Chairman, what does that mean?
It's the meeting of the it's an official meeting of the Western Conference Ocean Resources Committee. Now, it's also a meeting that's inviting legislators from each of the five states that are primarily involved with this legislation. So that's where I think that other legislators from this state and other states that have a direct interest in this may wish to attend a meeting as well. But it's officially the Ocean Resources Committee.